Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Today you'll be listening to the second half of an interview with Wesley J. Smith about transhumanism and bioethics. The first half of the interview can be listened to from changesurfer.com. I'm speaking today with Wesley Smith. Wesley is a former co-author with Ralph Nader of four books. He wrote with Ralph No Contest, Corporate Lawyers, and the Perversion of Justice in America. He's also the author of The Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America, and the book Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder. And one of the things that brings Wesley on the show today is that he actually addressed some of my writings after having interviewed me in an article in the National Review called The Transhumanists, The Next Great Threat to Human Dignity. So when someone deigns that I may be the next great threat to human dignity, they definitely deserve a voice on the show. Welcome, Mr. Smith.
Thanks, Jim. Please call me Wesley.
Okay. Wesley, you have been very involved in the anti-euthanasia and assisted suicide movement. What led you to be interested and concerned about the movement towards assisted suicide?
It was interesting. I was working very happily with Ralph Nader and co-authoring books with him, and I had a friend who I later found out was a Hemlock Society member who had more or less befriended me. She was an elderly woman. When I wrote a book called The Lawyer Book, A Nuts and Bolts Guide to Client Survival, which began my writing career, which was how to work with a lawyer and not get screwed, to put it bluntly. And she invited me to speak to her library association, which I happily did, and then somehow, I don't quite recall how, she became transitioned from somebody who wanted me to speak to becoming a personal friend, and she became a personal friend of my mother because they were the same age. And almost as soon as I started being her friend as opposed to the author, she started talking about her future deliverance and her gentle landing and using language like that, talking about how she had her hoard of pills. And I was always rather stunned by that concept. And she and I would go round and round about this idea. And Frances was a very depressed woman. Her husband had left her for a younger woman. He had subsequently gotten Alzheimer's disease. She had very difficult problems with her children that I won't go into. And she'd get suicidal, and then her friends, me among them, and I certainly wasn't her closest friend, would hold interventions. Just as one example, she was ready to kill herself, and then her husband, through his new wife, cut off her alimony. Well, if you really want to die, who cares, right? Well, suddenly the suicide was off, and Frances was off to court on a full head of steam to get her alimony back. And it struck me that what Frances was really desperately looking for was a reason to keep on going. But eventually, she did kill herself, put a plastic bag over her head, and took drugs. And I was very upset and disturbed by this. She was not terminally ill. She had had she needed a hip replacement. She had been diagnosed with leukemia, but it was treatable. She had some other issues, a nerve condition that was painful, but she wouldn't take her pain medication. And so I asked her executrix, please send me her suicide file, which I knew she'd have, because she was very organized, and I got that, and it was filled with Hemlock Society literature, which I was just appalled and disgusted at, because it, in essence, what they did was they almost proselytized for suicide. I remember one of the stories was how this loved one of the writer had giggled and relished the experience. I mean, we were talking about suicide here, and how people, when someone would say, I want to kill myself because I'm sick, would immediately jump courageously to help get the poison to do it. And these Hemlock Society, Hemlock Quarterlies, also had the drugs to take and their level of toxicity. Frances had underscored all of these things in yellow marking pen. And also an article about how to use a plastic bag, which is precisely what she did. I was really disgusted and enraged, because here these people who didn't know her, who I called the Whisperers, gave her moral permission to commit suicide and taught her how to do it, while those who did know her and her friends were trying to keep her with us. It was almost like this tug of war. So I wrote a article that appeared in the June 28, 1993 Newsweek, the My Turn section, called The Whispers of Strangers, and it got into my thoughts about what happened to Francis and what I saw as a threat to vulnerable people from this euthanasia movement that I was only just learning about. That led to so much hate mail that I was frankly stunned. I thought, when did the culture change and where was I when that happened? And then I decided to start working on these issues, talked to Ralph about it, explained why. He said, you know, go for it, buddy. And that started a whole path that I've walked since 1993 that I never planned.
That path has led to the pages of the National Review. Does that reflect that you have found more comfort and you're more in tune with the zeitgeist that you find in the cultural conservative circles than you do on the left now?
Well, that's all very interesting because, you know, when I start to write these about these issues, I'd submit them to publications like The Nation, and they weren't interested. So I submitted them to people like The National Review or Weekly Standard, and they were interested. And I believe, as a writer, in getting published and getting the word out. And in fact, there are a lot of, I've talked to a lot of progressives who oppose some of these agendas, who oppose some of the bioethics agendas, who oppose assisted suicide, certainly oppose cloning, and they have the same complaint that the journals of the left are very reluctant to get involved. I think there's a whole complex reason about that surrounding the politics of abortion and some other issues. But I'm a public advocate, and I'm going to get my work out, and I'm going to speak. And I have found, and do believe, that the old political paradigm that held true during the Cold War is shifting. That is, Jeremy Rifkin, who I've interviewed for my next book, which will be called A Consumer's Guide to Brave New World, said he looks at it, and he's certainly not a conservative, as the new paradigm is going to be those who see the intrinsic value of human life versus those who have a more utilitarian view and who don't see human life as valuable, say ultimately valuable, simply and merely because it is human. And on these bioethical issues, ranging from transhumanism to personhood theory to, we can get into these, feudal care theory, where some doctors are now, and ethicists, bioethicists, are saying that doctors should be able to say no to wanted life-sustaining treatment based on the doctor's or bioethics perspective as to the quality of life of the patient. What I find very much at threat is universal human equality. So I guess I'm speaking as being a lawyer. I always I'm making a short story long. I have friends in both liberal camps, quote unquote, and conservative camps now, and tell the same message to both.
Let's take a step back. You mentioned that one of the reasons why people in progressive camps are leery of the idea that we should be telling people not to that they can't have assisted suicide or that they can't have reproductive liberties of one kind or another is because the left.
Those two are different things. Let's not confuse them, and let's also not confuse reproductive liberties, e.g., abortion, with things such as cloning. I think we have to be very careful to define what we're talking about.
Well, that was, in fact, the question. I mean, that many of us, and certainly most transhumanists, think that the ability for human beings to control their own bodies and determine what's done with them, have informed consent, leads naturally to the right to determine that you should be able to genetically engineer yourself or take your own life, take drugs if you choose to take drugs, et cetera, a number of bodily liberties that our more paternalistic society denies us.
Well, it's a libertarian approach, and I'm now beginning to focus on some of this transhumanism that I was not aware of up till about 6 weeks ago. I look at two different things, and they all have subtext. First off, there is the idea of what you do to yourself, which is one thing, but also as part of transhumanism, as I understand it, is what you do to progeny or clones, which is not yourself. So I think you have to make a distinction there. If a person wants to modify themselves, I think there certainly should be some limits, because I think we have to protect people from themselves sometimes. For example, if somebody wants to take a cigarette and burn their arm, you know, a compassionate society protects people from doing that to themselves. That's why we have suicide prevention centers. There are some people now who are becoming quite obsessed and desirous of becoming amputees. And it strikes me that doctors should not comply with that request to be an amputee. Because actually what a doctor would be doing, even though it might be choice, is harming the patient rather than helping the patient. Then there is the issue of genetic engineering of clones or of progeny, which you are not doing to yourself, but you're doing to offspring or replicants, whatever we would wish to call it, and potentially on down the line, and are basically trying, and I think this is the intent, to seize control of human evolution, which I find to be incredibly hubristic, arrogant, and short-sighted.
Well, okay, well, let's return to the question of whether bodily autonomy extends to being able to have the kind of children that you want. But let's stick for the moment with assisted suicide.
Sure.
The argument that would be that why shouldn't one be able to have control over your own body and determine the means of your own death?
Let me ask you this. Would you put any limit on that?
Well, I would put the same limit on it that every referendum that's ever been proposed in the United States has put, which is that the patient should have to be seen by a psychiatrist, determined not to be clinically depressed in a way that can be treated, and that there should be a waiting period before they get access to the medications or the assistance.
Well, first, there's some mistaken facts there. There is no requirement in any assisted suicide proposal or law that every person who wants assisted suicide see a psychiatrist. In Oregon, that is only required if the physician believes that the person may not be able to make decisions competently. So most of the people who commit assisted suicide in Oregon never see a psychiatrist. And even when they have to see a psychiatrist, it's a consultation, it's not treatment. There is no requirement that somebody who, say, is depressed be treated. And by the way, once the poison or the drugs, whatever you want to call it, are prescribed in Oregon, there is no further medical involvement in that case unless the doctor chooses to. There was nobody to take a look to understand whether Kate Cheney even knew she was taking poison pills. There was no presence by the physician.
I agree, but that's only because we don't have the courage in the United States to have actual doctor-patient relationship administer these drugs. In Holland, where they're actually doing this, a physician comes to your home and determines, the competence of the situation and actually administers the drugs. Now, let me just understand you, Wesley. Is it your position that under no circumstances could we ever have a law with any series of protections that would allow competent people to control the timing of their own death?
Yeah, I think that you are betraying the very purposes of medicine. You are basically abandoning people. When you say, yes, of course, we should give you assisted suicide, it seems to me what you're doing is you're confirming the worst fears that people may have about themselves. For example, that I'm no longer lovable, that I'm a burden to my family, that I will be allowed to die in pain and agony. Moreover, it ignores the very many studies that show that even with terminally ill people, and of course, in the Netherlands, they go way beyond terminally ill people. They're even killing disabled babies now. Based on quality of life considerations, and they're allowing rational suicide of people who are depressed. For example, a woman who lost her two children, her psychiatrist assisted her suicide, and the Dutch Supreme Court said that was fine because she would never get better in terms of her emotional suffering. But there are studies for dying people that today they may say, I want to die, I want to get it over with now, and then 3 weeks later they may have a completely different perspective. So what you're saying is that with assisted suicide, that if somebody wants to kill themselves because their business has collapsed or their children have died or they've gotten a divorce, then we will engage in suicide prevention.
No one's saying that in Oregon. You have to be determined to have a terminal illness.
Yes, I agree with that.
Yeah,
but why shouldn't somebody with a terminal illness get the same prevention
as somebody
else? But
what you're doing, you're wildly extrapolating on the basis of fear of where the law is going to go way beyond what anyone's proposed.
Well, first off, most of the proposals that have gone out around the world do not limit this to terminal illness. In fact, the new term of art, and the Hemlock Society supports this, is hopeless illness. And a hopeless illness is not a terminal illness at all. Secondly, if you look at the Netherlands, they've gone way past, and they've been doing this since 1973, not only do doctors euthanize terminally ill people who ask for it, but chronically ill people who ask for it. They've now, as I mentioned in the Chabot case, C-H-A-B-O-T, the Supreme Court said it was acceptable for a psychiatrist to assist the suicide of his patient named Hilly, who wanted to be buried between her two dead children. And the Supreme Court said suffering is suffering, and it doesn't matter whether it's physical or emotional. And I don't understand, and that's the logic of euthanasia and assisted suicide. They also, in the Netherlands, Dutch doc study after study, and I'm not talking about opponent studies, but the government study, about 1,000 patients are killed a year by Dutch doctors who haven't asked to be killed, which violates every guideline. And when the doctors then say, well, they didn't have a life worth living, I'm sure they would have wanted this and so forth. So it's really been a disaster in the Netherlands, and well, would be here.
Okay. Only
in the Netherlands, they don't have the issue of HMOs and so forth, because you know, if we end up having a cost-cutting form of government financing, what could be cheaper than assisted suicide? It costs $40 to kill somebody in an assisted suicide.
Well, on that point, I definitely do agree with you. We should have national health insurance here and eliminate that particular thing, but which they do have in Holland.
Yes, they do. And
doctors
make house calls.
I'm speaking with Wesley Smith. He's the author of The Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America, and Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder. I want to take you back for a second to the comment that you made about respect for human life. You see a number of trends, animal rights as one of them.
Yeah, much to my surprise. I've only been recently focusing on that, but yeah.
And transhumanism and a person-centered ethics as all being a part of a cultural move away from respect for human life. Let me just say that that would be a surprising statement for most transhumanists at any rate, because we have coined this phrase thanophilia to describe the love of death in the rest of the society, and most transhumanists are trying to valorize life and stay alive for as long as possible.
But transhumanists want to transform themselves into post-humans.
Right. So the key then becomes respect for human life. So you would say that anyone who respects life that is not human is taking away from respect for human life.
No, I'm not saying that at all.
Okay.
What I'm saying is that our first and foremost priority, in fact, I think the only lingua franca we still have in our diverse and multicultural society, which I think is the strength of the United States and the West, is universal human equality. I'm looking at an article you wrote right now called The Future of Death, Chironics and the Telos of Liberal Individualism, in which you create this chart of descending rights, some of which would exclude humans from the same right, for example, to life and bodily integrity as other humans. At the top of your list here, you say type of life, cognitively enhanced posthumans, who you call mature personhood, and those folks have the right to vote and make contracts.
Along with humans.
Well, then I'm getting there. Then you say adult humans. Then in the next category, you talk about personhood, which is a lower level than mature personhood. Children, adult apes, severely retarded individuals, and some mammals who have the right to life. Then beneath that, you have infants, severely demented adults, fish, late fetuses, and permanently unconscious people who you call sentient, and you say they don't have the right to suffer, but they have the right they don't have the right to life, but they have the right not to suffer unnecessarily. Now you see where certain humans, those with less subjective criteria, that is consciousness, start to be used as objects instead of subjects, and that destroys universal human equality.
Well, I disagree. I think it what destroys human dignity is to treat something that has lost all substance that makes human life meaningful as if it still has it, and to deny the existence of those qualities in other beings. So, for instance, to look at a monkey or a chimpanzee that's pleading with you not to kill it and say, I'm sorry, since you're not human, I'm going to chop off the top of your head and stick electrodes in, and I really don't care, that violates human dignity in my mind. But to then treat a brain-dead person as if they still have everything and spend tens of thousands of dollars a year to keep this body going, that violates human dignity in my mind, too. And you're saying that we have to treat every brain-dead body as if it's still alive simply because it has human DNA.
No, I'm not saying that at all. First of all, somebody who is, quote, brain-dead is dead. Somebody who's been declared dead by neurological criteria and the brain is not working in any fashion as a brain from the frontal cortex, frontal lobe to the brainstem is dead. I'm not saying that at all. I am saying that when you have somebody who is not brain dead, who has a cognitive disability, whether it's unconsciousness or perceived permanent unconsciousness, which is often misdiagnosed, as you know, or a significant cognitive disability, they remain equal in every way as you or I. And because they have a lower level of cognitive capacity, doesn't make them any less valuable as a human being.
Do you think children and the retarded should be allowed to vote?
No.
Okay,
no,
why not?
They should be allowed to vote, but they should not have the right to life stripped away from them.
I'm not arguing that they should. I'm arguing that they should have a right to life.
Well, you've said in here that not to suffer unnecessarily. So you are talking about with regard
to... For fetuses. That's fetuses. That's not children.
Where does infants come in here? This looks like to me, and this maybe it's because of the printing... And surely, severely demented adults, you say, right not to suffer unnecessarily because they're right across from each other, which would mean, and as you know, people like John Robertson have opined, he's a bioethicist from the University of Texas, that if somebody is in a coma, we should be able, until we destroy the dead donor rule for organ transplantation, that we should be able to take their corneas because they don't need them anymore. That's harvesting human life. That is degrading human life and treating human life, and these are human beings, as less than dignified. And what would we do if they woke up and said, where are my corneas? Because sometimes people who are in comas and who are diagnosed as permanently unconscious do awaken.
Well, you're absolutely correct that my position, my bioethics position, shared by many bioethicists, as you have pointed out in your books.
Yes, that's why I wrote Culture of Death, actually.
Exactly. My position is that if you do no longer have or have never possessed a sense of self which exists over time, which has intents and purposes over time, which discriminates between yourself and your environment, and many permanently unconscious people who still manifest motion and other kinds of apparent life are permanently unconscious and will never possess that sense of self over time, as well as many fetuses and some infants as well. Infants at different stages of post-birth, that you have different claim on the rest of us than you would otherwise. Now,
that means that what we've done, if your approach is approved by society,
yeah,
is we have destroyed universal human equality and we've transferred that.
You say yourself that we can make a distinction.
Equality for persons.
You said yourself that we could make a distinction on some ground between children and adults in terms of their ability to vote.
Right, but that has nothing to do with their inherent moral worth. Well, they just do not have the maturity to be able to vote and for example, enter into contracts. But that doesn't affect their inherent moral worth.
But this gets to personhood.
And they're what we now call human rights, which eventually we won't be calling human rights if transhumanists and animal rights types have
their rights. Right, because what should have rights, the only possible thing that could have rights meaningfully, are persons. If you don't have a person inside the thing, then it can't have rights.
And that is a completely subjective approach. In fact, you've already taken it where I knew it would go next. You're now not only distinguishing, it's not only being a person, but you distinguish between a mature person and a person. So first we'll take away the rights of human non-persons, as they're called, and then eventually we may end up with gradations of rights based on personhood or mature personhood.
Well, you've already acknowledged that there are gradations of rights because we allow children to be held as wards of their parents and of the state in ways that we don't allow adults to be, and we allow adults to vote in ways we don't allow children to be. So there are gradations of rights.
The rights I'm talking about are not things like the right to vote or enter into a contract, but the right to life, the right to bodily integrity, the right not to be experimented upon, the right to medical treatment if that is what you or your family desire and so forth.
And does that extend down to the embryo or the blastocyst? How far do you take it, Wesley?
Well, that's a good question because if you can go, there's two ways to go. You take yours to the ultimate conclusion, and whole categories of humanity are being stripped of certain moral values that are very important. You take it to the other side, and you might start saying that a 10-cell embryo is the same thing as a 5-year-old child. And I don't accept that. However, I do believe, take abortion out of this, because there you've got this conflict.
I don't think you can take abortion out of this.
I think you have to, because the reason abortion is legal is that we're not wanting, under the law, to force a woman to do with her body that which she does not wish to do. The whole point of abortion was not to turn an embryo or a fetus into a thing that could be used and experimented upon. It was to protect the rights of women to use their bodies as they see fit and to protect women from being killed in botched illegal abortions.
So, okay, let's take abortion out of this in the sense that
right.
we have extrauterine gestation at some point. At that point, at the point,
my head's beginning to hurt.
Well, I'm looking forward to it because I don't think you are. Yeah, I don't think women are especially good at carrying fetuses. They tend to do things like drink, smoke. They don't take their prenatal vitamins, all kinds of things. But
well, I think you've got to be real careful here because there probably is more to gestation than the mere physical part of it.
And hopefully we'll have that all figured out. But let's get to that point. When we figure it all out and we have a good extrauterine gestation device and we have a blastocyst.
Well, that will be the end of abortion because if a woman doesn't want to carry the fetus, then just transfer it to an artificial womb.
Well, say we make six embryos or six blastocysts.
Yeah.
And we test them to see whether they have the different characteristics that we want. Would you be opposed to the discarding of the five, as we currently do in vitro fertilization procedures, in order to get to the one? Is that because that violates human rights?
Well, I'm very disturbed by that. I'll tell you why. In vitro fertilization, which I did not oppose and do not oppose, the point of that was to help infertile couples have a baby. I wasn't part of this debate back when it was being debated. But some of the things that were said by opponents of this was that you would end up making extras that would then just be tossed out. And you would then potentially start looking at these embryos not just as the potential to have a baby, but as fodder. And that is what's going on. So I think we've reached the end of the line in terms of where we should go with this. I think that if somebody wants to check an embryo to see, for example, whether they have Huntington's, that's about as far as I think we should go. When we start saying that we should be able to turn a human embryo, which is a form of human life, into a product and into a commercialized form of life, something that can be patented, then I think we are transitioning from a human approach which says we want these embryos to become children to one that is unhuman and is very crass and turns human life into a natural resource, which I think is wrong and which I think will lead to some very unfortunate consequences, not only for those embryos, but for society as a whole.
This has been the first half of an interview with Wesley J. Smith on transhumanism and bioethics. You can listen to the first half of the interview at changesurfer.com. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.